Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune into 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this for us as a public service presentation, which is a good price. We would also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society. As the family goes, so does the nation, so does the country. Basically, so does the world. What we found, most of the problem, the epidemic with drugs and alcohol today, comes from children that have not been taught correct principles. If children are taught correct principles, now they can teach themselves. But without those fundamental foundations of living, morality, they grow up like latchkey kids, empty lot weeds, the gangs, the clubs. Drugs, sex, and rock and roll. It worked for me, but right now that's what we find. Harold also goes to the prisons. And in the prisons we found, they just did a study, I think it was like a little over 80% of everyone right now in the prisons is connected directly or indirectly with drugs and alcohol. Wow, that's huge. The cost is unbelievable to families, to the nation, pain, suffering, and all because of drugs and alcohol. So what we do at Rum Radio, we try to go back to a basics approach with Alcoholics Anonymous, one individual working intensely with another individual with the same malady. We found this to be the most productive way of attaining and maintaining long-term recovery and sobriety. So Harold, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be on the program, and it's a privilege and a blessing to be in recovery. I just wanted to tell our callers that this is not a money-making program, neither is the website. In fact, Joseph has invested thousands of dollars getting them established and keeping them going, just as his way of giving back. And all of our guests and my presence here is my way of giving back. It is that action and more action is the way to keep my recovery going. And so that's this appearing here, visiting the prisons and jails, teaching recovery is the way I keep my recovery going strong and the way I express my gratitude to God who... is responsible for my recovery. If it weren't for recovery and for God, I would definitely be dead. I was going. So I just wanted everyone to know that this program is about working the steps with a sponsor. That's the main thing that keeps us all going and avoids relapse. And so we like to go back to basics. The website is full of really great information about how to work the steps, how to find a sponsor, and basically how to recover. So thank you for having me on and allowing me to serve. And let me turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Yeah, thank you, Harold. That's very kind of you. We also have on the website how to find a sponsee, which is kind of interesting because the culture of recovery today is that the sponsee, or the prospect, as it was called, which, by the way, is a sales term, was supposed to find the sponsor, and finding someone who has what you want. Because I really didn't know what I wanted when I came in. All I knew was I was in a lot of pain, and the folks here might have an answer. I really didn't want to be there, but it was sort of like we call it the last house on the block. It was like, okay, desperation gets you through the door, and now what do you have to tell me? So eventually I did find a sponsor fairly soon, because the pain was acute enough, and I tried to make a spiritual connection. What I found after 17 years of sobriety is that the Big Book gives clear-cut direction three times. I think this is a misunderstanding of attraction, not promotion, which is in our traditions. And because it says, go find a prospect and start working on them. Then it says, if your prospect is not interested in what you have, go find another who's desperate enough to want what you have. And then on page 19, it says, the man making the approach speaks to having the answer. So three times it gives us clear-cut instruction for the person who knows or the sponsor to go get the sponsee. It makes a lot more sense, because the guy coming through the door has no idea the culture, the jargon, what a sponsor does and doesn't do. Like I said, most of the time, all they know is they're in a lot of pain. And so they have to keep coming back to the meetings. Hopefully they can get the process of osmosis. They'll learn enough in enough meetings where they'll be able to go find a sponsor and take it at their leisure. What I believe, had this has occurred, the spin-dry cycle of the revolving door, where the pain dissipates, and then, of course, the motivation to work the steps are no longer there. Pain is the fuel, I believe, that I use to get my sponsees through the steps in a timely manner. Some people disagree. You get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. But my experience is that if you get them through the steps in a timely manner, at least they got the steps out. If they do go back out in a relapse, at least they have that in their head. And there's nothing so tormented as a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. Put it to you this way. The newcomer's life's blood to AA, just like the old timer's the backbone, but relapse is the soul. Because there's nothing so tormented as a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. And we leave the light on. So now they have enough in them to figure out to come back. I believe this works the best. Originally it said 50%, the Big Book quoted 50% got well right away and the other 25% after a few relapses. That's great recovery. Those are great numbers. I'd like to see that come back again. Huh, Harold?
Yes, absolutely. It's not anywhere near that high now.
We really don't know what it looks like. There's no definitive numbers. We know how many people have come in. They've counted. They did a census in 2010. 2,100,000 were in the rooms. And I think how they did that was the average number of people in a group, and then they added the groups up and things like that. So it's very kind of nebulous. If you go into some groups, there's not many people, and you go into some other groups, they're packed. So there's no way really to tell from ground level what the big, what the bigger picture looks like. But the folks that get around, you know, Chris R. and Clancy I. They put out little tidbits of information, and we get information back that way, and then from the General Service Organization. Oh, by the way, this is not AA. This is not Alcoholics Anonymous. This isn't NA, Narcotics Anonymous. It's not CA, Cocaine Anonymous. This is more like Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where you're holding the meetings. But if you're sleeping through your recovery and you're a member of Narcoleptics Anonymous, consider this a wake-up call. Well, we have a special guest. I say that every show, basically. I believe everyone in recovery is a miracle. Of course, we like to put on people of note because they have better jokes, and we also put on the regular Joe because who can put a yardstick on a miracle? But we have a celebrity tonight. I would consider him. He's very articulate, very well grounded. Been in here for quite a number of years. Has started other groups, other clubs. Is in with, you know, helping kids. He's really quite a inspirational guy here in the Houston area. So Dudley, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing just fine, Joseph. I bit my tongue. I wanted to make some comments as you were speaking. First and foremost, my name is Dudley Farenfeld, and I host a radio show called Recovery with Dudley. And like the mythical Stuart Smalley, I'm a member of several 12-step organizations, but in deference to their traditions, I won't identify which ones. But I was struck as you discussed Alcoholics Anonymous because in the old days, the original groups, they wouldn't let you attend the meeting until you had actually worked the steps. And they would. There were six steps that came from the four absolutes of the Oxford groups. And, of course, Alcoholics Anonymous is the great granddaddy of all 12-step programs, and in some ways has almost been a victim of its own success, as at the other 12-step programs. AA has several step study books, the 12 and 12 and the little red book. Narcotics Anonymous has its own, It Works, How and Why, and even OA has their own 12 and 12. But I was told to talk about what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and I don't like to remember what my Sunday evenings were like, but I need to remember what my Sunday evenings were like. And they weren't pretty. In the state of Texas today, I hold five mental health licenses, and I've had a career in social services and continue to. I've spent a lot of time with working with adolescents and also working with what is known as a dual diagnosed, and do a lot of educational work now. I'm taught at U of H briefly, and the Institute of Chemical Dependency Studies. I'm on their advisory board and do all kinds of other stuff. There has been all kinds of changes. The Internet is beginning to change stuff, but so has the openness and the stigma. And when I came into the field of treatment, the people on the chemical dependency side and the people on the psychiatric side didn't trust each other and often would sabotage each other. That's no longer the case. When I heard you mention Harold was an interventionist, years ago I was Johnson Institute certified, and we don't see the kind of interventions that we've had before. I'm still very critical of the professional graduate schools and not explaining what chemical dependency is and how to treat it. The one thing I can say about the social work community is because they focus in on family systems, once they can understand alcoholism or chemical dependency is a primary disease, then treatment becomes a little bit easier. But in my personal stories, I'm from deep south Texas. I have a long history of alcoholism on both sides of my family. I was a child of the 60s, and in my case, the chemical dependency was primary. Right from the get-go, drugs and alcohol did things to and for me they simply didn't do for other people. In fact,
How old were you, Dudley? The first time that you drank a drug and it rang your bell?
Well, I'll tell you, it's not quite that simple. I was 6 weeks of age when I was given phenobarbital to sleep. I was a colicky child, according to my mother, and I stayed up for 3 days, and so the pediatrician suggested whiskey sours. I don't remember any of that. I do remember being.
Did you get it with the umbrella? Did you have an umbrella with it?
No, I don't remember any of that, but I do know at 8 years of age, my father offered me a sip of beer. He was a European at the dinner table, and I drank the whole can, and I had the bed spins. And then at age 12, as I was graduating from the sixth grade, I went to my best friend's house. Mother went out to get us a pizza. We drank everything in the liquor cabinet we could get our hands on. The last thing I remember about that night was dipping pizza in milk, and the next morning I wake up at my grandmother's with them beaten up, and so was my bicycle, and no memory of the night before. And I was to be sober a couple of years when I realized that was my first alcohol-induced blackout.
Yeah,
I joke about it. The year I was 20, the summer of 72, I went to Europe, and I had a five-day blackout in the red light district of Amsterdam, and I think I might have had a good time. You know,
Understand. Yeah, you were out of money, so you figured you must have had a good time.
Well, I was out of money when I got there, and I won some money and a kilo of hashish, and then that was on a Sunday night. Monday morning, I went to the Heineken's brewery, and it was for one guilder all you could drink, and the next thing I know, it's Friday night, and I'm talking to some ladies of rather questionable standards. Even by my rather questionable standards at age 20, that was a bit much, 5 days lost. A couple of years later, I'm at a fancy restaurant, Charlie 517, in the Houston Theater District, and I have a very vivid technicolor memory of projectile vomiting all over my ex-mother-in-law. And again, I joke about it, but if I could control my blackouts, I'm not sure...
I like that, though. You threw up on your mother-in-law. That's got a good ring to it to me.
I was wearing a bright blue velvet suit, so, you know. And it was step one, subchapter A, our wives had become unmanageable.
Mm.
I had a career. I had a good family. I did a lot of things right in even during my drinking and drugging days. I worked my way through undergraduate school, received a bachelor's from the University of St. Thomas, went to work for CPS, and after a year with them, went to what they called their night crisis unit. And, you know, I could blame my drinking and drugging on the horrible things I saw, but the honest truth is it was inevitable. Whatever job I was doing, I was going to drink a drug. And I had a number of tragedies in my own life around 1976, and I decided I should quit drinking and drugging, but I had no ability to do so. And I thought, I know what I'll do is I'll get into graduate school. And it took about two more years before I entered graduate school, and how I didn't fuck out is kind of beyond me, but eventually the summer of 79, I managed to get arrested, and I had lots of arrests over the years, never any convictions, but that family got me into treatment August 3rd of 1979, and Today marked exactly 1 week and 35 years I've had the gift of recovery.
How many years?
35 and 1 week.
Wow.
But
congratulations. That's quite the accomplishment.
Well, but I'm real clear. That's because of a power greater than myself. And I'm also clear that I only get to keep it if I give it away. So when you talk about sponsorship, I would also include all kinds of service work and 12-step work, because nothing protects us or grants immunity so much as intensive work with others. And I will tell you, you do not have to be around 12-step programs very long before you start seeing the tragedies.
Yeah, I know. Let me ask you this. Now, I know Bill wrote that if sponsorship, loosely said, but if sponsorship wasn't for you, if you couldn't do that, there's other things that you could do. Do you think that was kind of a cop-out, that he wasn't necessary to say that, that it would have keep the pressure on? And I tell you why I say that, because on the 12 and 12 on step 5, it says, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone, and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So what I hear is I have to speak a fifth step, and then I have to hear a fifth step. And who hears a fifth step is a sponsor. So if I didn't hear a fifth step, I still don't belong. I'm just circling the field waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline. What's your take on that?
Well, I would tend to agree with you, but I'd add a couple of things, Joseph. One is, if someone in any of the 12-step programs asks me to sponsor them, I don't tell them no. I feel, it doesn't matter if I like them or don't like them, or political or ethnic or religious or occupational. None of that matters. If they want help, I feel an absolute obligation to do the best I can for them. When I listen to a fifth step, I pray for forgetfulness after I've listened to it, but I also tell people if they can come up with something that I've never heard before, I've got a $100 bill for them, and so far I haven't lost any money. Now, having said that, if you're going to talk about the literature of 12-step programs, one of the great assets or treasures of Alcoholics Anonymous that has sometimes been lost is the Little Red Book, which is a step study guide. And it was written by, it's actually a compilation of papers written by a member of Dr. Bob's home group. And there are people who will say that it's not AA conference approved, but the actual reality is, when it and the little 24-hour day book came out, it Works Publishing, the publishing arm of Alcoholics Anonymous, didn't have the money to publish it, so they Hazelton published it as a favor to them. And with the fifth step, the 12 and 12 of the little red book tend to parallel each other, but there are some differences, and it depends on which steps you look at. And I will tell you, the Little Red Book probably stresses sponsorship quite a bit more than the 12 and 12. And unlike the 12 and 12, the Little Red Book constantly references the Big Book. Now, the Little Red Book was published a couple of years after the 12 and 12 was, but it was actually written when most of the folks had only 1 or 2 years of recovery beneath their belts.
Right.
And it's an interesting, it does not go into the traditions, just the steps, but it's an interesting comparison. And one final thing, so I don't get into trouble on this issue. The Little Red Book has recently been reissued as the Little Red Book for Women, and it has a white cover, and it has all the annotations for women, and I've encouraged people to read it. It's well worth
it. Well, no, when you say for women, you mean women sponsors, women sponsoring women and the special nuances they have for the gender proper. Is that what it is?
That's essentially yes. Although you bring up another issue, in the very early days of 12-step programs, there was more cross-gender sponsoring. Now, I don't do that, and there is a real reticence to do the cross-gender sponsoring in most groups today. Once in a while, that happens. Of course, one of the big changes in society as a whole, and it's, and I think, frankly, 12-step programs kind of led this, is the way people are viewing gay relationships and gay people. And I say that because I've had some situation where lesbian women have found male sponsors or gay men have found female sponsors. I don't particularly push that, but it's not necessarily something that I would lose any sleep over.
Yeah, I don't. I have it on the website. I suggest same gender because it's easier to identify with. But what it really boils down, you know, because it's very intimate. Sponsorship is an intimate relationship, and it can be easily misconstrued under some circumstance. Why put another hoop into the mix? You got enough going for you at the time. But if it comes to working the steps, you work the steps. And if the sponsorship's not working for you, you could always get another sponsor. So the key is really to work the steps in a timely manner. So it just a suggestion.
Absolutely. But sometimes people come with other issues, and multiple addictions, for instance, or the transgendered, or who knows what.
Sex addicts, all of that.
Yeah.
All of that in a can of worms,
And often people will come to me and say, why do I need multiple 12-step programs? Why can't I just go to one? And, well, sometimes you need that extra identification and support. And sometimes different programs have different emphasis. For instance, coming back to that little red book, it's the only piece of AA literature I'm aware of where they suggest you put yourself on your 8-step list. Now, several other 12-step programs, OA, NA, suggest putting yourself on that 8-step list, but most of the AA literature does not suggest that, but the little red book does.
You know, that's interesting. They just had on, I belong to several Facebook chat rooms, and some of them get pretty thumpers and all that, and that came up. Do you put yourself on the list? I've never heard of that. I don't see the practicality, you know, because it's fairly explicit. It says, you know, we, as long as it doesn't harm anyone else when we go make an amends, but we're kind of like, if it hurts you, it's okay.
Well,
as long as it doesn't hurt someone else, well, then you go do it. Your pain at that point is not really put into the mix. Am I reading it wrong?
I would say so, but there is some difference of opinion on this. And I have some funny stories. I have a friend who recently passed. He wasn't quite a sponsor, although he was pretty close to it at one point with me, Dick R. And Dick had some wreckage of the, and he told this story many times before his death in meetings, but he wanted to impress his sponsor with how sincere he was. He'd come from a good family, a background in business, but he became an armed robber and a cat burglar, and when he got sober, he had to go to TDC for a while, and knowing full well the statute of limitations had expired on a robbery, he confessed to it to impress his sponsor. Well, at first it didn't impress his sponsor, but second, the very next day in his cell, he had the IRS showing up harassing him for unreported income. And so the first 20 years of his recovery, he had to make some amends to the IRS. So
oh, that's...
I,
The Al Capone, codicil or whatever. That's funny.
Well, he also was fond of saying, you don't owe amends people that were on your side when you were at war with the world. But I also think there's been a bunch of illegal cases involving 12-step programs. And generally speaking, what's said in a meeting does not have a cloak of privilege.
No.
The issue with the sponsor is a little bit different. Now, at least one of my licenses that I hold does have the priest's pendulant of confidentiality, but that gets attacked periodically. So again, each case is somewhat individualized, and I figure I think of a sponsor as really a spiritual advisor.
That's the way really the big book, the 12 and 12 puts a little bit more emphasis on in the little red book too. My experience with that is, you know, of course the Bill did 2 fifth steps. And the second one was with Father Dowling. So the assumption would be, because we don't know what, that he did 2-4, so the assumption is that it was the same fourth step that he came out. But why Dr. Father Dowling was because there was things that he needed to get out that were of a nature that he wanted to make sure there was no chance that it went abroad. And that he, that could have been a liability, a legal liability, if someone found out. So I usually suggest that the sponsor, if there is something like that, and that's happened, it happened in a home group in Austin. The police found out that this fellow was in AA, and they were looking to prosecute him for a robbery, I believe. And they found out, and they subpoenaed his sponsor to the stand. And the sponsor was obligated to reveal what was revealed to him in a fifth step. So I usually make that real clear to my sponsees. If there's something of a felonious intent to go to someone who has privilege, but I can hear the resentment end of it. I don't, you know, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. The big book is a little bit more nebulous about it, I think, because they really didn't have the experience with it. You know, anyone who knew what we were driving at and didn't try to dissuade us was sufficient to the need of hearing a fifth step. Or the 12 and 12, again, it says, you know, on step 5, a sponsor. What do you get on that?
Well, there's a case. First of all, I don't know of anything modern research has come up with that contradicts anything in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me put that down first. But I think we've learned a lot of things, and I'm not sure the first 100 could have foreseen the kind of some of the kinds of legal problems. I'm not familiar with that case in Austin you're talking about, but there were 2 other cases where it involved the groups. One involved a sexual assault, and the guy wanted to make amends to the woman, and there was a second person involved, and he ended up going to jail behind that. And the other case involved a homicide, and that somebody had talked about it and while in a blackout. So, you know, you want to offer protection to people, but and I think you're right. I like the way you phrased it, Joseph. They can talk about the resentment part of the feelings without getting into specifics. And for instance, I do not have privilege when it comes to child abuse or neglect, molestation.
Oh, you're right. No one does.
No one does. And with clients and/or people in the program, I make that very clear. From the get-go. The other side is easier said than done when it comes to reporting that, and as someone who has some first-hand experience, 40-some-odd years ago when I left CPS. I didn't think I could get any worse in this state, and it's gotten a lot, lot worse, which is a tragedy. And, of course, we could talk about children who grow up in alcoholics' homes often learn not to trust, not to feel, not to talk. And then when people come into a 12-step program, we say, trust us, talk to us. And they have
What did they used to say? The folks in the program are from Penn State and the state pen and just released from the local booby hatch. We let airline pilots in here. And well, heck, we're so open we even let attorneys. That's the bad news. The good news is that we're the solution.
Yeah. Yeah, we meet the most interesting people, some from the state then and some from Penn State. And sometimes they may even have done both, you know. So we, and you talk about knowledge. Interestingly enough, the last pardon that President Clinton gave as he was leaving office was to the guy whose story Grounded is in the Big Book. But the pardon came after the book went to, after it had been published. So, just a little aside there.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Again, 12-step programs, and of course, Alcoholics Anonymous is great-granddaddy of all of them. My experience with the others are that if they take the steps and the traditions, they do fine. If they take just one, then they get into trouble. And I like to say we do the steps so we don't kill ourselves. We do the traditions so we don't kill each other. Now,
my personal experience is most folks either they rely on the soundbite on the wall and really don't get the spirit of the traditions, or they have
that.
I don't get it.
And I think you're right. For instance, anonymity for Dr. Bob Smith, and sounds like an alias, but and for him had less to do with keeping his name, last name private, and had more to do with doing good deeds and not being found out for him. And in fact, asked that no mention of Alcoholics Anonymous be made on his gravestone, and none was. And I'm brought back to an old psychiatrist, Alfred Adler, who once said, if you really feel bad for yourself, what you could do is do a good deed every day for 30 days, but it won't count if anyone else finds out about it. And that's the kind of anonymity that Dr. Bob was
saying. Dr. Bob was. Yeah, he said there was two ways you could break anonymity, in press, radio, and films. And if you were so anonymous, the other drunks couldn't find you.
Yep. But
so he was more interested. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, there were thousands upon thousands of alcoholics he helped sober up medically without getting compensated for. I mean, there were times he made money, too. But in the early days of... it was originally the Alcoholics Squadron of the Oxford Groups, and the name Alcoholics Anonymous actually came from the book, not the other way around. But in those days, most of the people who came in the 12-step programs were what we would call last gaspers. They had one foot in the grave. Oddly enough, in the little red book in step one, the last major heading is that they warn about the use of drugs, which, of course, is another one of those little tempests in a teapot that you sometimes hear around the room.
Oh, yeah. Let me ask you this. Now that I have you on the phone, I wrote to this. Some of the people really like it, some don't. But most like that, though. I really believe that... I call it singleness of porpoise. You know, I don't see it holding water, and that basically it contradicts the third tradition, because the drug addict did come in, you know, what would the master do, meaning Jesus, what would Jesus do? We had to let him in, and it turned out really well, and he helped hundreds of people, which turned into thousands because of the length of time that it washed around. But who did he help? He was helping either other addicts or other alcoholics, mostly other alcoholics, but he was a drug addict. So in the 50s, Bill comes out with Singleness of Purpose, and I go like, well, why would you do that? I mean, you know, now the bleeding deacons have a soapbox to say, no, you don't belong here. What's your take on that?
Well, something I would talk about pure asses, and I would. There are one of the things I don't like, and is World Services when they went from the third to the fourth edition, they changed Dr. Alcoholic Addict to the acceptance story because there were people who didn't like the term addict mentioned in the big book.
No,
on
brother.
The other hand, if you read what's in the little red book, they were very succinct in saying that you don't do drugs. There is a sort of naivete with Bill and some others that alcoholics would have enough sense to stay away from other mood-altering chemicals. Now, Bill wrote some stuff that was kind of crazy, and I love Bill Wilson, but he had his issues. And one of the things, he wrote a pamphlet on the benefits of niacin therapy, and he also wrote a hilarious letter to hippies. And you know, if you shop around for opinions inside of 12-step programs, you can find all kinds of nonsense and stuff. There's what is known as a Texas preamble, and it was what was read in Texas meetings about 50 years ago. And in there, it very pointedly says, if you can't square what's said in a meeting with what's in the big book, you probably don't need to pay attention to it. And it's true that Bill was probably the main author of the big book, but there were 100 others that were there. And if you ever doubt that they had an influence, there are copies of the original manuscript, and there were something like 58 changes in how it works that were implemented by the first 100 before they would accept it. So there's some interesting history there. There's a wonderful book, if someone's interested in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, called Not God, A History of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's written by a Yale-educated historian named Ernest Kurtz, and it was his published Ph.D. dissertation from Yale University. And everything is documented a dozen ways from Sunday, as you expect with a professional historian.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, you know, it's funny. The longer I'm in, the more the history seems to jump out at me more, like my interests have changed. You know, it was like just trying to stay sober and then working with sponsors. And then, you know, the concepts still elude me, though. I haven't been able to get much. I was trying to get somebody to write to the concepts. I've written to the traditions, and how ballsy is that? You know, if you're on the website, it's interesting. I put the tradition, highlight the idea, and then write to the idea using other traditions and the steps or whatever literature. So it kind of brings it out a little bit more. Like Eddie Rickenbacker's story is, you know, the whole story is available there, and why they came out, Shoemaker, See to Your Last, all that. So I try to get to the, and what I've learned by doing that is that I get to the spirit of it, what they were trying to accomplish by writing the traditions. There's even a section, I don't know if you're familiar with this, Dr. Bob didn't want the traditions.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
And,
yeah, you knew that. Okay.
What I was going to tell you is that one of the things I've really enjoyed, and it's an Al-Anon workshop on the traditions and relationships. Mary Pearl, who's an Al-Anon circuit speaker, has gone around applying the traditions to romantic relationships.
And who Joe McFadden, if I don't break his anonymity, did that too. He did a piece on that. I think I got it somewhere, where he related to his marriage.
and the traditions. Was interesting the way he put it together.
Yeah, and I did a series on recovery with Dudley on the traditions in relationships, and it's an interesting concept, but it's a good one. Half of all marriages now end in divorce or more.
My first sponsor, Kenneth, told me early on. Of course, you know, when you first come into the program, whatever your sponsor tells you is like, you know, like the law, like a general, you're in the battle. You know, this is a very, it's cut and dry. And he said if looking for a mate in AA was like looking for Olympic hopefuls in a polio ward.
Well, I would probably not be quite as unkind, but I've heard it said that if you're looking for a relationship and a 12-step program, the odds are good you'll find one, but the goods may be odd.
Yeah, and then the other one was under every skirt there's a slip.
Yeah, it's Bill probably had some issues there. I don't believe he ever ran around on Lois until after he was sober. And according to Kurtz, he received Lois, nobody begrudged her receiving royalties from the Big Book, but one of Bill's last mistresses received some too. So he had some issues in that area.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, you know, my experience is I hate to say most, but my experience is that a lot of people in recovery have a sexual addiction is a secondary addiction, and I think because the alcohol reduces inhibitions, and if you've been drinking long enough, you have little or no inhibitions to back off on. Now you're sober, but you still have little or no inhibitions. I mean, a friend of mine says, "How you've been to the fair and kissed the bear." You know, now you're sober, but all those other issues seem to come to the front now with a vengeance. Is that your experience?
Well, yes, but again, I don't want to confuse things, but there's a couple of points I'd make. One is there's a study out of UCLA, Stanford Medical School, it's a few years ago, but it suggested if there's one major addiction, there's at least two secondary ones. I see that with tobacco, I see with marijuana, what have you. Second, certain chemicals, addictions, especially cocaine and to a lesser extent methamphetamine, tend to really mess up the libido and the sexual behavior of people that are addicted. And then I'm fascinated because we're seeing some demographic changes in this country that I don't think people know where it's going to take us. For the first time in our history as a country, more women are choosing not to get married than getting married. Somewhere between 1 in 7 and 1 in 4 marriages starts on the Internet today. 1 in 7 marriages are between couples of different ethnic backgrounds. What was considered the liberal position on gay relationships has now become the conservative one in just 10 years in domestic partnerships. So there's all kinds of changes that are going on, and the way we look at families are changing too. And in fact, the majority of kids, as I understand it now, are being born outside of marriage. And while people may not like some of what we're seeing, the reality is with us.
Yeah, it's just that's the society. Now I wrote a post, and I think this might go hand in glove with what's going on. AA threatens to fire God, demands more benefits and less participation. Clancy I had made the statement, it came around to me, I get this stuff, I don't know where, but that he, since he travels all over the country, he noticed enclaves in certain areas of the country where it's become more and more agnostic and atheist, almost in a militancy, where they're just pushing God completely out of the rooms. And then I believe somebody told me in New York that actually AA is starting to split under those circumstances. I don't believe it's so much that it's AA or the recovery community. I think what's going on is that this is a general tendency in the society, and that AA and the other sister recovery groups are mirroring what's going on in society as a whole.
Well, there's a couple of ways to view that, and I'm going to refer to some literature. One is you mentioned that third tradition in the 12 and 12. Right at the end of that tradition is a story about an agnostic atheist who the group really found really difficult and obnoxious, but they went ahead and kept working with him anyway, and eventually he came around. Ernest Kurtz makes the argument in Not God that Alcoholics Anonymous almost had the start in the United States because of our history of religious tolerance. And that, and he has a point. And of course, religious freedom to me means also freedom from religion for some.
Sure.
And you know, doctrinal distinctions are kind of laughed out now. The Oxford group describe themselves as primitive first century Christianity, but the other side of that is I could make a strong argument that Alcoholics Anonymous and the other 12-step programs are much closer to the Eastern traditions, because in Christianity, salvation or forgiveness is just given, whereas in the Eastern traditions, you have to continually work at becoming a better person and becoming actualized and growing spiritually, which fits much closer to the 12-step philosophies than some aspects of Christianity. There are some groups, and I expect I don't have to push my spiritual beliefs on anybody, but there are groups where they don't say the Lord's Prayer because they considered it an implied endorsement of Christianity. But, you know, there are also some men's meetings that I'm aware of where people don't say hi, they don't hold hands, you know, they what I call testosterone dementia. So those things have a way of...
I've been there at the contractor's meeting. It freaked me out the first time I went. I go like, where did these guys come from?
Well, I'm not going to mention specific personalities or meetings, but again, there are... And I got to say that my experience with all 12-step programs is we're a little parochial. Wherever we came in, we tend to view that as the right way to do things. And even small deviations, you know, can get people upset. And I think it's frankly kind of silly.
You know, like Red's meeting, is that still going? Is he still alive? You know?
That meeting is still going. He is no longer there. He is still living. He just had a birthday. I spoke to him last week for his birthday. He's in Austin. I don't think I can say that.
Yeah. Nobody known the last name. That me locally people would know, but that's not a break of anonymity. Good. So I'm glad to hear that he's still kicking. How old is he now? 95?
92.
Okay. He just seemed older. He had that Mark Twain-ish shtick going. He was really quite the sharp guy. He was still very... agile. His brain was always very agile for the most of the time I heard him. Let me ask you now. We say that alcoholism is a twofold or threefold. I look at it as a threefold disease: mind, body, and spirit. And of course, it's a spiritual malady. Now, if I have a new sponsee and I'm a Christian and I do the Jesus deal, but if they haven't come to an agreement of anything, I said, well, they can pick anything they want, give it attributes that would be, you know, fitting for their recovery. The only thing I suggest that they don't get is a higher power is a doorknob, because eventually the doorknob will turn on you. So I tell them, I says, now look, the one thing, though, the big book requests us to do is to pray. And so, you know, and the knees show humility, and so I make suggestions. These are just, and I always explain these are always just suggestions, which basically is a subtle command, but it's just a suggestion. They don't have to do anything. I can only make a suggestion and tell them what I believe with my experience, what the consequences would be for not following through, which doesn't really mean anything. Like you said, if you get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. So, you know, there is the preamble says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, which implies that there is a specific path that we follow to get to where we need to go. It's not all roads lead to Rome, but eventually everybody works their own program, and I get that. And some people will disagree, but eventually you're going to work your own shtick. However that looks like, and you're staying sober and it's working for you, who am I to tell you that it's not what it's supposed to be? And I get that. I think what the important thing is, though, is that the newcomer at least gets the right, the initial path to be the path that is directed by the big book. You agree with that?
Yes, I do. I would add a little bit more. When you talk about the doorknob thing, I tell people you need to have a higher power that works for you. And I seem to have run into any number of ex-Jesuits after I came into recovery. And I know one, Jimmy O, who was one of the founding members of what became the Men's Center, and his first higher power was a bottle of Irish Rose whiskey. And that worked for a while for him until some old wino sold the bottle and drank it. So I do suggest people find something that works for them.
Okay. If it's a spiritual, let me ask you this. If it's a spiritual concept, right, you know, like some of us say we're spiritual beings having a physical experience. That's some folks.
That's actually a quote from Tiller Desjardins, who was an excommunicated Jesuit. He said we were spiritual beings trying to have a human experience.
Ah, okay. I said it was Stephen Covey, so he grabbed it from him. There's nothing new under the sun, right? That's what King Solomon said. But you got to remember, though, that was before Facebook. Back in his day, they called it Bathsheba book. There's nothing. The only thing that travels faster than bad news is good gossip. So you can always, that's why we call it the grapevine. We'll always find out what's going on. Now if it is a spiritual ailment, a spiritual disease, a spiritual malady, right? And we die in our disease. We die drunk. We die in addiction. And the body is not available to go through withdrawal. Is the spirit still have that malady?
That's a theological question. And as a psychotherapist, I'm often asked spiritual questions. And why I had a certain amount of philosophy and theology as an undergraduate student, it's not something that I'm really competent to talk about. But what I can say is this. I am convinced that when 12-step programs say it's a physical, emotional, and spiritual disease, they're right, and that it is progressive, which means that if you stop for a while and you go back, you don't go back to where you left off, you don't start over again, you go back to where you would have been if you'd never stopped. And the medical documentation in the case of alcoholism and alcohol and the physical progression has been made. And it's not proven empirically, but I'm convinced that happens emotionally and spiritually as well. And
I've seen it. I've seen it happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can't put your finger on it, but if you've been around long enough, you'll see a guy with long-term sobriety, he goes out. We all wonder what happened. I believe, you know, we never know for sure. It sounded like a good idea at the time. He failed to expand his spiritual experience, life on life's terms. It was either suicide or taking a drink. Go take the drink, you know. So we never know. We're alcoholic. We drink. That's what we do. So, you know, who's to say when it could happen? So that's why it's a daily reprieve, and I get that. But what I've seen is once they go out, the damage that's done in such a short period of time is usually deadly.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I would just say that people can make it back, they can recover, but it takes a huge effort. Two things. I would tell you that the disease of addiction or chemical dependency does not strictly fit either a medical or a psychiatric model, but it is a disease in every sense of the word. A few years back, I was lecturing at a fairly prominent treatment facility for mental disorders, and the doctor there said, "Dudley, you're telling us chemical dependency is not a psychiatric illness?" And I said, "No, I'm not saying that. But think about it for a moment. When you have somebody who's bipolar or schizophrenic or depressed, you're trying to get them to take a medication. In the case of addiction, alcoholism, chemical dependency, you're trying to get them not to take something that every part of their body tells them to take."
Oh, that's a good point. What'd they say?
Well, they listened to me, and I had a treatment center for adolescents, and they actually referred someone to me. But that was, they were dealing with brainstem problems, and it's another issue. But again, today I've seen a change in the treatment field where people no longer distrust each other quite as much as they did 35 years ago or so.
Well, tell us about you have a radio show, and then you're doing other things now, TV. You got any books coming out?
Well, I'm working on a book, and I do have a Recovery with Dudley. It's going to be in the 8 area of AM radios. I also run a community mental health center during the day, and I also have a small private practice, and I am involved with the Ben's Halfway House that I've been involved with for over 28 years. I stay active.
Well, give us contact information. So if we have any listeners that need some of these, some of you personally as a therapist or as a halfway house, where is that located? You know.
Okay. Well, let me.
Yeah.
Okay. The TV show. TV production costs are horribly expensive. Radio and it's a lot cheaper. By the way, I have a face and a body built for radio, but you can reach me through the internet, and it's DudleyFahrenthold@hotmail.com, all one word, all lowercase, and I'll spell it DudleyFahrenthold@hotmail.com. One more time, DudleyFahrenthold@hotmail.com, DudleyFahrenthold. Now, the men's halfway house that I'm involved with is called Last Chance Recovery Center, and their phone number is 713-529-1581, 713-529-1581. The first Tuesday of every month, I do an hour lecture there, and that's free, and it's open to the general public. They're located near Antoine and 290 in the Houston area. The community mental health center that I manage is called Daybreak Rehab or Daybreak Community Mental Health Center. It's near the intersection of West Orem and Post Oak. I stay active. And if somebody is looking for a private therapist, send me an email and I'll return the I'll call back or return the email.
Do you have a Facebook also? Everything's on Facebook lately.
Yeah, I am on Facebook, but I've got to tell you, it's not real reliable, and I've been hacked a couple of times, so I'm a little leery. The Hotmail address is probably the safest one.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Well, but if you call Last Chance and leave a message, I'm sure they will get it to me, or Daybreak.
Last Chance Recovery. Now, the Noah's Ark deal, what is that? The Noah's Glen.
That was a treatment center that's closed now that I opened up, and we were open for a little over 4 years for adolescent males who were chemically dependent or dual diagnosed. I went ahead and opened my own treatment center, but the state of Texas makes it very, very difficult, and it's very hostile to both chemical dependency and mental health issues. Right now, Harris County Jail is the largest psychiatric hospital in the state of Texas, second largest in the country. And you mentioned the high number of people that are incarcerated that have a drug or alcohol problem. That's true, but we've also now made them repositories of our mentally ill. And in Texas, we actually spend less money on a per capita basis than Guam or Puerto Rico. And I tell people we have third world status here in Texas.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
That's just, especially here in Houston. I mean, even during the economic downturn, I mean, there's always money in Houston. I mean, this is one of the reasons we live in Houston. There's two reasons you live in Houston. Do you know that? You either have family here or you're making money. Unless you're an alligator. You're in the swamp here.
Well,
I was looking Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you can see it in the homeless, and yeah, a lot of them do have mental health or alcohol problems, but I'm seeing women, I'm seeing the elderly, I'm seeing vets, I'm seeing the disabled, I'm seeing more and more of that. And you mentioned 12-step programs. You often see the mentally ill coming in because they have no other place to go. Now, Houston does have a number of P11 groups, which are the 12-step meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous for people who have to take medication.
Yeah, they have. I've been going to the Delta group. They have a nice one up there.
Well, there's been a bit of a controversy between AA Houston Intergroup and World Services, but that's another issue.
Well, yeah, you know, it still goes back to the traditions. Every group is autonomous, except when it affects AA or other groups as a whole. I mean, you know who Cersei is, right? You know Cersei?
Oh, yes.
Right. Well, I got to hear him twice in the 24-hour club in Austin. This guy would go anywhere. He was like 6'4". Maybe 227 years
sober when he passed away, and there's a funny story. But he actually got irritated with me. But that's another story.
Did he really? Oh, usually he was really quite. He had quite the gentle demeanor.
He spoke at the dedication of Last Chance Recovery Center, and they had me introduce him, and I made a little quip about him and Viagra, and he got irritated with me.
Well, when I heard him, I got two stories out of him. One I have on the website about the, he was the 10th member of AA and Bill W. sponsor and sponsee, as they would swap off at different times as they were traveling around the country together with the need of the bleed of sponsorship needed. So they would, sometimes he'd be the sponsor, sometimes he'd be the sponsee, and back and forth. And then Bill had handed him the envelope that had the scratches, the first scratches of the traditions on it. He tells that story, and he said, when he read it, he said that he turned around to Bill and said, maybe you northern boys need this, but southern boys were a little bit more refined than that. And the end of the story was, aren't you glad I didn't start AA? The guy was a corker. I think the only reason he remained alive as long as he did is because he was on his mission.
Absolutely.
I've never seen, how about you? We're about the same age. Had you ever seen anybody that large and that old?
Not too often.
Other than him, I've never seen anybody that large and that old. Usually, by 90, you're about 5 foot nothing. You know, just like gravity has got its way with you by now. But he was huge. I mean, the guy was just like, whoa. You know, he looked like a Shar Pei. You know, most of the hair was gone. And then the other thing I heard him say was about one of Bill's favorite sayings. I believe it was in the late 60s when wife swapping was vogue. And an AA group developed around that platform of depravity. And a moral indignant went to Bill and said, Bill, we have an AA group that is, they're practicing wife swapping. And Bill said, well, are they staying sober? And he says, well, as far as we know, yeah, they're staying sober. He says, well, then every group has the right to be wrong.
Oddly
I believe
enough,
that's the, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say in the 60s, or part of, as I understand it, Travis Club did not want a lot of young people there, and part of that was they had a nude young people's meeting.
Oh, yeah. AA comes of age. Here we go. Well, Harold, you've been very quiet. Are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still here and just enjoying the conversation. You guys are a lot of laughs. And I've heard some very important things tonight. I think the main one is that intensive work with another alcoholic is the thing that we need to focus in on that really helps us with our recovery and our sobriety. So thanks for coming on, Dudley. That was a great program.
My pleasure. And as I've heard it said, there aren't any big shots in a 12-step program. One shot, we're all shot.
Yeah, no, that's the key. Chris R. Was on. We've had Dr. Father Bill W. Kathy Kinnan Lindert. Jimmy Kay's daughter wrote a book on her dad starting NA. We had her on there. So we've had some real interesting, and I got to say, Dudley, you're probably one of the most interesting fellas we've had on there. So I really appreciate you. Hand of AA. Go ahead.
Thank you for the kind words, but I've got to be honest, it's mostly plagiarized.
Well, hey, look, I'm telling you know, King Solomon said there was nothing new under the sun, you know. As a matter of fact, I was at church today, and I had written a piece for them, and it turned out, after I read some of it, the guy said, wait a minute, I heard that at another thing cross-country. He says, is that something going around? I said, no, I came up with that myself. So it's that kind of a deal. I think it's sort of like universal consciousness. When something comes around, it comes around to a lot of other people. It's not just the one person. So T.S. Eliot said, immature poets imitate. Mature poets steal. So you're a mature poet. Look at it. That's the way I look at it. I think some of my best work has been done by other people.
Thank you both for having me this evening.
You're welcome. Our pleasure. In closing, I like to say Rum Radio is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. This has been helping quite a few people. A lot of people like it. I get about 7 blessings for every curse. So I guess we're making strides. You got to look at the audience. We're not a group of folks that like change in any way, shape, or form. We're a group of anarchists, and we're all self-promoters. So if you're a self-promoter in a room of self-promoters, good luck. Anyway, so remember, if you're looking for good sponsorship information, it's Rum, and we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
You're the daughter. My mother's name is Catherine.